Warning, this episode may contain subject matter that some listeners might find disturbing. There is brief description of animal abuse, child abuse, and sexual violence while on the topic of veterinary forensics. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Tales from a Vet Tech with me, Tabitha Cusera. Today, we are talking to the awesome Dr. Michelle Gonzalez all about her career path, which led her to opening Rascal Charities and her interest in veterinary forensics. So we get into lots of interesting topics today. I hope you guys enjoy. Dr. Michelle, I'm so stoked to have you here. I know we've been trying to get this scheduled forever, and both of our schedules, we are doers and we are all over the place, which is a beautiful thing, but I'm so stoked to have you on.
Thank you so much. I'm so stoked to be here.
So I met Dr. Michelle in my animal welfare work and we immediately hit it off. She's amazing. And she's one of my veterinarian friends who works in animal welfare. There's only so much of us. We have to know each other and help each other out. So she has her hand in a lot of things. So I wanted to bring you on to talk about a little bit about all of it. But to get started, do you want to talk a little bit about how you became a vet, your career path, and kind of where you're at now, which I know is a very loaded question.
Oh, it's a huge question. But no, I mean, I'm really, really lucky because there's a lot of people that it takes them a long time to figure out what they want to be or what they want to do when they grow up or what they want to do with their life. And I was really lucky that from the earliest time that I could say words, the first thing I said was, I'm going to be a veterinarian. I had no family members that were vets. Like, my family had animals, but they were not like big animal lovers. And that's all I wanted to do since the get-go. So I was very just driven towards that. Many people along the way told me, you don't have what it takes. Your grades are not good enough, or your attitude's not good enough, or whatever. And that just push me to just get it. So here I am. So yeah, I went to I went to Michigan State for my undergrad, and then I went to Ohio State for my veterinary degree, which is an amazing institution. I'm really happy with the education that I got there. Then I did an internship for a year at the University of Missouri, and I was in private practice. And while I was in private practice, one of the ways that I try to help build up the client base was by reaching out to shelters and rescues. Then helping the rescues. And then, you know, it helps with PR because people see that we're helping the community and helping the rescues. And then the rescues were giving us leads as far as more client base. And
do y'all hear that? Do y'all hear that amazing, beautiful thing that we can all do? And you're right. That low cost places and vets do not need to fight because... can help each other. But anyways, continue.
So I mean, exactly. It is you give and you get, right? Yeah. So, and it's like this karma world that we live in. It's you do good and you get good. So one of the big things that I saw is that we were getting a lot of animals for surgeries, for spay and neuters, because we were giving the rescues a pretty good deal.
Right.
And it was like a never ending line of dogs and cats. So I started asking the rescue, like, where are you getting all these animals? And they said, not even just from local, but they were getting animals from kill shelters in other counties, especially Southern Ohio, rural Ohio.
Right.
So I started thinking, how do I help the problems, right? So helping the problem is not just helping the shelters take care of these animals, is where's the root of the problem?
Right.
So then I spent some money and bought a truck and said, okay, let's take the truck to the rural areas and do spay and neuter.
How long were you in GP before you were like, let's do this? And I did it.
I did that for about 6 years. I was in GP for 6 years. And then, yeah, I bought the truck. And at first I thought this is going to be like, you know, 1-2 days a week. Like, right. How much work can you get? No, from the get-go, it just blew up because everybody needs accessible, affordable care for their pets, especially in these areas in Southern Ohio, which is where we see the most struggle. Like everybody, every place has areas that struggle.
Right, for sure.
But just that Appalachia area, it's just really,
there's a lot of veterinary deserts and like right. where people even who mm-hmm. want to provide care and are aware, because not everyone is aware of what care looks like based on mm-hmm. their learning history and their all that stuff. But
right.
people want it and they can't, whether because they can't drive or there's no vets. So mm-hmm. you literally were like, I see an issue, which I love, get it done.
Right.
But you saw an issue, you worked in GP, you became mm-hmm. a vet, and then was it called Rascal Unit from the beginning?
Oh, yeah, it was Rascal Unit from the beginning. And it actually was an acronym for Roaming Animal Sterilization Clinic at Low Cost.
How did I not know that until just now? Oh my God, that's so, so awesome.
Our Rascal One truck actually says that on the side. And then people started getting confused about the name, like roaming animal. Like, are we only doing roaming animals? Like, it means that we roam, but people didn't understand. And eventually it didn't matter anymore what it meant, because people associated the word rascal with affordable, accessible care. And not just affordable, right? Like I say, we're low cost, we're not cheap. So the care that the animals are getting are high quality care, right? I went to vet school, I did an internship, I practice high quality medicine. So I wanted to kind of provide that high quality care at a low cost. And it is possible. It is doable. It's a lot of work. Like my techs and I, we just bust through the day and we work really hard. At the end of the day, we're tired, but we help so many animals and we help the people that come with the animals, you know?
And I know you just started with spay and neuter mm-hmm. and that was, how many years has it been now? Oh my gosh.
16 and a half.
It doesn't. That is crazy.
It was pretty crazy because I had my son on February 9th and then I got the truck on March 15th. So I had a 5-week-old child with me as I'm starting this venture. So yeah. And he is the oldest child. So my son is the oldest child. So he's the preferred child, but I have two kids. I have my son that I love and adore, and then I have Rascal that has provided so much stuff for so many people.
And then I know when you started it, were you still working in GP and doing Rascal Unit like 1 or 2 days a week with spay and neuter, or did you just full on like say, "Whoa, I'm going all in,
all out"? Well, so the idea of it, I didn't think it was gonna be something that could sustain me. So I thought I was going to stay in GP and then do that. And then the place that I was working at first they gave me the green light. And then as I'm getting close to getting this truck, they're like, no, we don't like the idea of it. So you have to pick one or the other. I was like, well, I already bought a truck. So
yeah, it's a little late for me to back out now, guys.
Exactly. So I just decided to set that aside and take the truck out on the road. And I've been super, super lucky that from the get-go, it just did so well, because again, it's something that is needed. It's something that there's nobody, well, I shouldn't say there's nobody. There are some other similar outfits out there providing similar care, but it's just not enough.
Yeah. And I know there's a lot of, in the years I've been working mm-hmm. and some of those options, like the orgs that were offering it stopped offering for various reasons. So it would come and go. And even with the pandemic in animal mm-hmm. welfare, access to veterinary care for shelters have been, again, multiple reasons why, but mm-hmm. that's been a whole nother challenge. And I can't even imagine how it was for you guys during the pandemic, because things were just crazy.
Yeah. And you know, I don't even know. I mean, like when we go to different places, to different counties, we are brought to those places by hosting organizations, right? So different humane societies, shelters say, hey, Rascal, we want you to come to our community and help our community. And we like that because, I mean, first, it's collaboration. I'm all about teamwork and collaboration. This is not the Rascal show. This is the let's get these animals fixed, right?
Right.
So we're providing the surgery, and then these hosting groups are doing a lot of work in setting up the appointments because they know what their county needs. So we go to places that just want to do cats, and that's fine. We go to places that just want to do dogs, and there are places that want to do everything. So the community the hosts know what the community needs. So, so we schedule our clinics way in advance. Like right now I'm working on next year's schedule. So within the next couple of weeks, next 2023 is going to be fully booked from January through December. And if I could have 2, 3, 4 more veterinarians, we could do that many more clinics. But you know, right. the scarcity of veterinarians and technicians and everything affects everybody, and it affects us as well. So we just go out there and help as many people and animals as we can.
And I know you just started with spay and neuter, but have definitely transitioned into offering a variety of different services. Could you talk a little bit more about how that, probably because it kept coming up and you're like, well, what else? This is, I'm here, the animal's under anesthesia. Can you talk about what kind of other services you've offered and how you kind of got there?
So one thing, kind of going back to my education, was that I've always been very interested in surgery, and not just spay neuter, just surgery in general, orthopedic and soft tissue. So even while I was in private practice, I did a lot of continuing education on different orthopedic procedures, fracture repair, knee surgeries, that kind of stuff. I stayed in really close contact with the doctors at Ohio State, especially the orthopedic department. So that, you know, I have a mentor there that helps me and guides me with different things. So when I started doing the unit, it was, primarily spay neuter and then the occasional dental cleaning, but people need low cost everything. Right. So we would get the, you know, oh, well, my dog is urinating blood. Okay, well, we don't have the stuff to figure it out. I guess we're going to buy an X-ray machine. So we bought an X-ray machine. And then it's like, okay, now we have an X-ray machine. So look, it has stones. So we're doing cystotomies. And then we started getting orthopedic problems and knee problems, knee surgery. So after a period of time of doing all that stuff in the truck, which the truck, the surgery suite in the truck is fine. The concern with the truck was more the aftercare.
Understandable.
So that's where about, you know, 6, 7 years down the road, we opened the Rascal Animal Hospital, because that way we were able to offer overnight care and more like hospitalization type stuff. So we were still offering different surgeries. A lot of mass removals is one of the biggest things that we see on the truck. And then we were doing other things at the hospital. Unfortunately, after COVID, after everything, the ability to retain veterinarians and to find veterinarians that wanted to do the high volume, high quality stuff, it was just not happening. Right. So we had to basically sell the hospital side of it, but kept the unit, which is, I mean, it's really important. It's what provides service and care, not just local, but everywhere. And I mean, my surgical skills did not stay at the hospital. They came with me. So that, you know, you can't take that away from me. So little by little, we're building stuff again. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, we did a knee surgery on a dog that's doing amazing. So we are able to offer these services at a discounted cost to the client, because our overhead is also so low because of the facility that we have. You know, we're working out of a mobile unit that is self-sustainable. We don't have a lot of the overhead that other facilities do. People ask all the time, how can you be so cheap?
Right.
Well, again, we're high volume. So when you do high volume, you're going to have a profit just because of the volume that you do. But because of high volume, we have better opportunities as far as purchasing things. And again, just the thing, we get discounts. So what we do is we just pass those discounts on to the customer, to the client.
For sure.
And then we also have a nonprofit called Rascal Charities. And Rascal Charities is a 501c3 nonprofit that is able to obtain grants and funds. So through that, we can get additional funds. Like we have an anonymous donor that is big into pit bulls, and they want to help pitties. So so they give us grants. And then with those grants, we help these pit bulls. Currently, we're helping a pit bull that is heartworm positive. That her dad is a veteran on disability, and he put money together to get her spayed. And then we found out that she has heartworms and they can't afford it. So, you know, thanks to this anonymous donor, we're able to help this dog. We're able to help with like space and neuters and that kind of stuff. So even though our prices are really discounted, there are still people that struggle. The struggle is real.
Yeah, we can't. we can do a lot, but, right. And like you said, it's, I talked on the podcast with another veterinary clinic that's actually a fear-free certified low-cost veterinary nice. Clinic. Mm-hmm. And we talked a lot about how low-cost care doesn't mean right. and should not mean low-quality care. Obviously, right. there are differences in some things, right. but animals are getting pain meds. And like,
right. exactly.
you know, pain exactly. is being assessed. Mm-hmm. And one thing I love about you is communication is a big part of mm-hmm. our job. And right. especially a lot of the clients that you work with, mm-hmm. Many of them have never even had access to veterinary care. So they're
right.
And you're talking to them like as you should, mm-hmm. like a human, and communicating right. with them in a way because you know they love their dog. And
right.
your communication skills, as well as your veterinary technician, are you guys are so genuine and empathetic. And I think that's a big part of your success because we've all heard like some of the low cost care places, mm-hmm. it's more like an assembly line, mm-hmm. and the clients feel very disregarded. And right. when there's question, you know, they feel less than, which is just horrible, but it's just mm-hmm. the fact of it. And I know that you've worked really hard to kind of create this culture with Rascal Unit, whether it's the stationary right. place when you were open or the truck, mm-hmm. As far as building that communication and that collaboration. So when it comes to the more specific surgeries, like the orthopedics mm-hmm. and the heartworm, do you guys still do, because obviously it probably comes up at these clinics, but
right.
do you always collaborate? Hey, because there's so many, this mm-hmm. shelter or this rural area that this shelter is hosting you. And then you kind of have the spay neuter other things scheduled, or do you kind of have exam assessments with the client sometimes as well?
So we do wellness clinics.
Okay.
And those are just for wellness. Now they're just for wellness, but it's like, here's my dog for wellness. He hasn't eaten in a week and
yeah,
he's
for
lost
sure.
50
for
pounds sure. and that kind of stuff. Because again, like people need, so they kind of figure I'm just going to try to get, you know, what I can for my pet. So during the spay neuter clinics, because we have so many animals and so many surgeries, we try not to schedule a lot of wellness stuff. Some
totally
of the rescue organizations will allow like a few vaccines to come in, that kind of stuff. Or they will allow people to come in for a consult because their dog has a tumor or mass or something like that, or, you know, dental disease or something. So yeah, you know, education and communication is huge. We go to places where people are not taking care of their animals, not because they don't want to, because they don't know or they can't.
Right.
So as the veterinary field, myself and my technicians, it's our job to educate people. Once they're educated, if they don't want to do it, then they're just being ignorant, and then that's on them. But if they don't have the tools and the knowledge, then you can't complain to them. You can't say, oh, this person's stupid because they're not, you know, giving their dog heartworm prevention every month.
Right.
They don't know. A lot of people don't know that heartworms are transmitted by mosquitoes, you know, like they don't understand what's going on. So going to places, educating people. Our technicians are really well educated. They'll spend so much time on the phone with clients, like explaining to them, these are the options. These are the things, this is why it's important. You know, it's like, yeah, we're selling something, but we're selling health for their pets. So it's the importance of letting people know what their animals need to have a better quality of life.
And for veterinarians and other veterinary professionals who, because again, I love the idea of collaborating, because mm-hmm. as someone that works with animal welfare and vet med and behavior, right. I think the collaboration thing is such an yeah. important thing, even if it's us just educating each other. So
right.
the shelter knows when to contact if they don't have a vet on staff, for example, and they have to right. triage mm-hmm. and there's no credentialed veterinary technicians on staff and they're doing the best they can. But
right.
we could help them. What suggestions, I know I'm putting you on the spot, what suggestions would you have for veterinarians or shelters, vice versa, who would love to start to collaborate and build relationships, whether it's a vet with the shelters in their area or a mm-hmm. shelter with the vets in their area, even if that vet can't work there full time. But again, I tell right. this, like, we're all crazy busy, like things right. are insane. So, hey, I want to have five different people I can possibly call, and you may only be able to do two space for me a month, but mm-hmm. that's sick.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. And that's one of the things that I say, we mentor a lot of students, like veterinary students, and we do externships and stuff. And one of the things that I hope that I impart on them is the importance of shelter medicine and community service, so that, yeah, even if it's once a week, every 2 weeks, even once a month, that they can go to a shelter and provide service. And you don't have to provide it for free. A lot of these shelters have the funds to be able to,
yes, definitely, to pay a veterinarian. 100%.
Yeah. So it's not even that. So it's teaching the vets and the student and the technicians the importance of giving back to the community, because that's kind of where it's at. And that's what builds up trust. It builds relationships. It builds a client base, because people like people that want to help. So yeah, I mean, any veterinarian out there, if they can just give one day here and there to local rescues, it would make a huge difference. We have a few of the shelters that we've worked with for 16 years that over time, some of them have gone from no building to creating a shelter and then creating a spay neuter clinic within their shelter. And I'm so excited and happy when they do that, but then they can't find a vet to help them out.
Right.
And, you know, they spent all this time and money and effort, and then they still don't have the assistance that they need, because they can't do it without a veterinarian. So all it takes is, yeah, a vet coming in a couple times a week. And if anything, also, like, it's good practice. You're doing a lot of surgeries. You're getting better. You're improving. You can take that to your practice and then be more efficient. I mean, it's a win-win situation.
And how would you advise? Because I feel like for veterinarians and even veterinary technicians, we could reach out to shelters to an extent. But mm-hmm. also, I understand the conflict there as well, because I'm comfortable with a certain quality of care, yeah. and not mm-hmm. every place.
Right.
Offers that quality of care.
Yes.
And I do low cost care, and I, mm-hmm. I do it in a way where I'm ethically comfortable. So it's possible.
Right.
And the goal is to yeah. transition, get our field and animal welfare mm-hmm. to push it that way. But
right.
how would you recommend, if a shelter, with the exception of, like, obviously putting an ad out on Indeed or something, mm-hmm. reaching out to vets, or vets maybe reaching out to a shelter that they may want to help with once a month? Hey, I would love to, this is me. Right. And I would love to tour your shelter and chat, because you should mm-hmm. meet them and see the shelter.
Oh, absolutely.
But mm-hmm. how would you recommend doing that based on all your awesome experience with that?
I mean, I know that a lot of the rescues that we work with put all that stuff on social media. Like, they're constantly saying, we need help. We need a bed. We need a tech. We need help. So, you know, that social media is a great place to try to find out. And there you can even kind of creep a little bit on their profile and stuff and see what they're doing.
Research is important. You want to make sure you're a good fit, yeah. even if it's once every two. Right. Yeah, for sure.
Exactly. And you know, to your point of the quality that they're offering, I would never sacrifice my quality of care for this is just how they do it. Right. You know, you can, if you have a set standard and you go to a rescue and you say, hey, I'm here to help you out and I'm willing to do surgeries, I want to see what you have to offer. I have done this at a couple of shelters that I've gone to, and they show me what they have. And I tell them, okay, these things are okay. These things are not okay. So for me to come here, you know, like there are some places that will use pain medication as an option and people have to pay for it additional. I tell them, to me, that's not optional. I don't want, like, if I'm hurting, I don't want somebody else deciding if I get Advil or not. Right. I decided I need the medication. So it's the same for these animals. So I'll tell them straight up, and it's not being rude and it's not being picky. It's just sticking to what you believe is true. And then it's up to them to say, yeah, we're able to make these adjustments. And if they say no, and it's not okay for you, it's not a good fit, then yeah, walk away, because it's not worth risking what you believe to be true for, you know, for.
And then
for
you're
what
also
you're doing.
Planting seeds, because mm-hmm. I work with so many shelters and they're amazing and they find mm-hmm. me. Right? Right. Like your shelter, like they are like asking for help and they mm-hmm. find these people. I'm usually right. doing behavior related things. I'm sure you're surprised. Mm-hmm. and I think in many cases, like, I realize that many shelter professionals are kind of thrown into doing medical procedures that they're not comfortable mm-hmm. with, but there's no staff and no right. one taught them how to hold a syringe, how mm-hmm. to, you know, things that as a behavior consultant and vet tech, as a teacher, mm-hmm. right. I teach my client and I'm like, you like, no wonder you guys are so stressed. And they're, I think a lot of them are open. A lot of the low cost places I've worked, I said, mm-hmm. oh, actually that's not how vaccines work. And they right. weren't doing, they weren't giving boosters or something mm-hmm. like that, right. where mm-hmm. that no one told them. Like,
right. again, it comes back to education.
Exactly.
Right? Like, they're not ignorant because they don't care. They're ignorant because they don't know. So if they don't know how to do it right, they're going to keep doing it wrong.
Right.
And a lot of people, yeah, they, if you tell them this is the proper way to do it, this is the best way to do it, and you say it in not a condescending way,
of course,
like, oh yeah. my God, I can't believe you're doing that, right? It's more like, hey, you know, okay, so you're doing the best that you can. This is what you're doing. This is what actually should be done, and then help them transition into that. And yeah, most shelters and rescues and are open to it. And if somebody, I know that most of the rescues that we work with that have a spay neuter clinic that's just sitting there empty, if they get a vet to come in and that vet says, this is how I want to do things, they'd be like, yeah, here, you know. Like,
yeah. And I think that's sometimes, I think that's a maybe a common misconception. Because mm-hmm. in my experience, it now, have I had experiences on the other end? Yes, I'm sure we both have, mm-hmm. whether it's behavior, because behavior, that's a whole nother woof. But with medicine, mm-hmm. most of the shelters I have worked with have been very receptive to yeah. now getting the executive director and the rest right. of the, I mean, I'm going to be honest, this is real talk, y'all, mm-hmm. Can be challenging, but I think that's even more important because I meet so many even amazing veterinarians who work at these shelters and they're doing their best and they're being told by boards who have zero experience
mm-hmm. right.
that you don't need to into just stuff mm-hmm. that is, it's bizarro. Right. So,
yeah.
But the more of us advocating, even if you only go once every 2 weeks, mm-hmm. like I work with as a vet tech, I work with many places occasionally because I have so many other gigs mm-hmm. and I plant seeds and then they progress and learn more and know where to find right. information if I'm not available. Like you said, I think that's a really good point. I know we kind of mm-hmm. went off on a thing, but I think it's just so important. Yeah. And then along with the beautiful Rascal Unit and this beautiful culture and thing you've started, as you've been doing this, you got interested in other things
yes.
regarding veterinary medicine that I would love to nerd out with you about. Because she happened to tell me this at a conference we were both speaking at. And I had to go speak. And I was like, I want to talk to you for like 3 more hours about this. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So, you know, the Rascal is like the puppies and kittens and butterflies and pink glasses and all the happy things that happen. But the reality of veterinary medicine, animals and everything is that unfortunately some animals are not having a good time and there's a lot of cruelty and neglect and things that need to be investigated. And I've always been very interested in that. As a child, I used to watch like Cops and all those shows and it's like, okay, let's get the bad guys, but I'm still going to be a vet, but let's get right. the bad guys. And then I grew up and I was like, hey, guess what? There are bad guys with animals and I can go out there and catch bad guys and do that kind of stuff. So University of Florida offers a master's in forensic medicine, veterinary forensics. So I did that program and it was an amazing program, great experience. And I learned a lot of the stuff that you have to do to basically investigate animal related crimes and whether it's a crime against an animal or an animal is involved, things like that. And I've been really lucky that I've gotten to work with both local organizations, some like small humane officers, all the way up to Humane Society of the United States, right? So doing hoarding cases, doing examinations for animal abuse, neglect, that kind of stuff. And as I was studying that, I started seeing, okay, well, this is the animal side of it, but why are people doing this? So then, okay, I always ask why.
This is why I love right? the show.
so it's like, okay, I just got done with this veterinary forensics master's. I have time. Sure. So let's do another master's. So I embarked on a master's of forensic psychology through Southern New Hampshire University. And that was a master's basically to understand human personality and behavior right. and theories of personality and kind of what drives people to do stuff. I'm really, really interested in hoarding and animal hoarding because it's a disease. And a lot of people see it just as a crime. And the person, yeah, they're doing something and something needs to happen, but they also need help. So
and there's because I've been involved in a lot of hoarding cases, mm-hmm. As well, of course. And it's so surprising to me because it's kind of like, I love humans, but sometimes we repeat stuff and I don't understand why, but these people are suffering from a mental health issue and we may take their animals away, which is appropriate, guys. I'm not saying it isn't.
Absolutely.
But then they move over to a different state line and do it again. And no one focuses on the core. There's shows about hoarding, for gosh sakes. But when it comes to mental health resources for hoarders, there is like,
there's none,
nothing. And I just don't understand it. But anyways, continue.
So that was one of my biggest things. Like my final project was about how can we help hoarders not be hoarders?
Right.
Because again, like you said, like you take the animals away, you're not taking away the problem.
They're going to just continue. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, and these people are not hurting these animals on purpose. Like a lot of them truly love these animals. Like you're taking away their kids. They just got too many kids and they're not taking care of them kids, but they're attached emotionally to those animals. And it all comes back to what they themselves suffered as children and the losses that they've had and the needs that they've had that have not been met. So, I did like a whole project on how we can help animal hoarders kind of basically not be hoarders. And hopefully that's something that as I keep doing more work with more organizations, hopefully I can get in front of like judges and say, hey, you have all these fines, you have all this stuff that means nothing. You're going to do all this probation that means nothing. You're going to say that you're going to evaluate this person that means nothing. But how about setting up some kind of program to help these people be around other like people, and then, you know, they let them be allowed to have a dog, like one or two animals, and have them supervised because they can care for those animals and then help them heal and help them get better so that we don't just go into the same vicious circle.
Because in many of those cases, they're not taking care of themselves, and that's
right.
Mm-hmm. That's a whole nother thing in treating, because I always joke that I'm a unicorn because I love humans, kids, and animals. But like, I know in animal welfare and vet med, that's not always the case. And I get it. But whether we're going into a city to help educate them, mm-hmm. whether it's about spay and neuter or behavior or whatever, or hoarding, mm-hmm. we have to, sometimes I think people mean well, but they go in there judging the people and not realizing these people use a quarter of the paycheck that they barely have to feed this cat. Yep. And they can't take care. So I think, thankfully, I think we're making some progress in understanding that in animal welfare and focusing on pet retention and how we can support the human. But hoarding's a big part of that, because half the time they're not taking care of themselves. And then it's this repetitive, and it's hard for, I mean, I care about that human, but also for the people working the hoarding cases.
Right.
I recognize how challenging that is. I've been involved in these cases. So I think it's all about looking at the core problem, which in this case, we've found the problem. We've seen the problem. How can we help these hoarders? And it sounds like you've already found some great ideas. Mm-hmm. It's just implementing them and getting that out there to the world. So I think that's so great.
Yeah. No, yeah. And yeah, I mean, you walk into these places and it's not like they're clean and sleeping well and their animals are filthy. No, they are walking barefoot on this poop infested floors, poop and pee everywhere, like disaster everywhere. One of the last hoarding cases that I went to, the woman, all her beds were covered in dog poop. So she had this tiny little area, little like mattress by a window, and that's where she slept because there was nowhere else clean. So, you know, and we think about, oh my God, how can she live like that? It didn't start like that on day one.
Yeah.
This is something that builds up slowly, little by little, by little, by little, and they get probably nose deaf and vision deaf at everything that's going around them. So yeah, you know, it's get them out of the situation, get them healthy, because they probably have even health problems from all the ammonia and all the waste and everything they're around with, but help them. Mental health is just, like, it needs so much work everywhere. And with these people, you know, it's like everywhere. So yeah, for these people, it's just so important to get it done. And it is possible to get it done. It just, somebody has to care.
Yeah. And I think, right? I think in some cases there's only, and this is where that collaboration mm-hmm. is so important, because like you mentioned, yes, we can, the state can give them a fine. The shelter right. can get those animals out. Mm-hmm. Cause again, it's going to take a multifaceted approach
right.
to help these people. But it's the same thing. I love true crime. Mm-hmm. And I listen to quite a lot of it because of the behavior. Also, let's be honest, I'm a woman right. and women are, it's helpful for us to be aware. I'm just right. being honest. But I love true crime. And a big part, like I wrote a paper in tech school about, even back then, I didn't realize how much I liked true crime, but about how many people, like serial killers and mm-hmm. other people that are very dangerous to other humans, cause horrible pain and torture mm-hmm. and kill animals first. Right. Mm-hmm. So even if you're not vegan or a vet tech or like animals are your life, like me, we as a country need to mm-hmm. take, I mean, we need to take women, violence against women more serious, but that's a whole nother thing. But we also need to take violence against animals more serious. Mm-hmm. And that's where I'm thankful that, because the veterinary forensics is, it's still a very new, so I mm-hmm. love that you're like, I'm going to jump right in. It's still a very new thing. And I know that it's being used a lot in cases, like hoarding mm-hmm. cases, cases of neglect and things like that. Even cases towards other, like, humans getting injured and there happens mm-hmm. to be a dog, you know, all right. there's so many fast like areas where mm-hmm. veterinary forensics could be helpful.
Right.
But, and I know at work you've even, which we don't need to share the stories and that's okay. Right. If you're not comfortable, but you've seen that as well, where you've been mm-hmm. able to identify some concerning behavior that maybe even the parents weren't aware of, right. not maliciously, and that mm-hmm. child was struggling mm-hmm. and the parents weren't aware that someone was doing horrible things to the child. And through what you found in the animal, you got help for right. that animal. But I'm going to get emotional because you got help for that child.
Right.
And it's, and ideally per every true crime thing I hear, you hear about obviously genetic, it's the same thing with animals and humans. Mm-hmm. So many things affect learning and who we are as people, but these horrible experiences happening to children obviously results in many cases to people right. hurting people when they get older. Right. So could you just reflect on, I know you guys, this is like a deep, I'll put a trigger warning before
yeah.
before the episode, because not, but this is a part, like you said, yeah. our jobs are difficult. And
yeah.
I think we all deal with challenging things. And the more tools and structure, like, and data, where obviously there's going to be emotional component, but when you could look mm-hmm. at data and say, this is what I'm seeing, which is where I think right. veterinary forensics can be really helpful. Or even mm-hmm. as a veterinary professional, sometimes identifying neglect, that's mm-hmm. a whole separate skill. It's difficult.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because, you know, animals come in and stuff happens. So they yeah. can come in injured, and you have to be able to identify, you know, is it an actual injury, like an accident or something that happens, or did somebody do something to this animal?
Right.
And you have to kind of a little bit follow your instinct. You can't just come into a room and be like, what do you do to your dog?
Oh, of course. You know? Sensitive. Yeah,
exactly. And the more friendly you are, the more people are going to share with you. And then, you know, it's like telling them, I'm here for your dog. I'm here to help your dog. I'm here to whatever. And then trying to get the information. But if we feel that there is neglect, that there is abuse, we have to do something, because a cat getting abused, there's probably a human in the house getting abused, whether it's a child, whether it's a woman, whether it's right. a man, because there are women that be men as well.
Yes.
You know, like, so somebody else could be a elder abuse, you know, so it's really important to take that step and not get in the mentality of how is that going to affect me? To me, that's just selfish. If I go into a room and I think that that dog is being abused, and my thought is, well, if I report them, how am I going to look? No, you know what? No. How, if I don't report it, what's going to happen? And sometimes we're wrong, and it is okay to be wrong as long as it's not malicious. So when they were passing the law about having to report the mandatory reporting for veterinarians, I actually went in and testified for it because I absolutely believe that it needs to be done and that veterinarians need to feel protected.
100%. Yeah.
Right. So yeah, when that law passed, that was really amazing. But now the next step is teaching people how to do this, how to recognize it, what to do, who to call, and how to safely approach these cases. So the case that you were referring to, that it was a pretty horrible case from the get-go, and somebody else saw it, and I think they suspected something was wrong, and they didn't want to deal with it, so they sent it to us. And the dog came to us, it was injured, and the father thought, yeah, my kid was alone with the dog, and then the dog got injured, and when I brought the dog to the back, it was clear to me that that dog had been sexually abused. And it's my job to either be like, oh, I don't want to get involved, okay, I fixed the dog up, here's your dog back, or do something. So I went into the room and I told this father, your child sexually abused this dog. And it was really rough. It was really, the father was very emotional.
Of course.
He called, the child actually was in the clinic that day. He made the child come into the room. And I looked at the child, having a teenager, I have that mom look. So like, I'm going to stare at your eyes and you're going to tell me what's up. And I asked him flat out if he did. And then he told me that he did. And a lot of people get the mentality of that kid is done, right? Like there's no hope. They might as well just lock him up because he's going to grow up to be horrible, a pervert, a molester and all that stuff. Right. In my eyes, we caught this kid doing this for what I believe was the first time. How can we help them moving forward?
When you see a young child, like what is, again, figuring out the why and,
right.
And I,
exactly.
The dad in this case was not, he came home and mm-hmm. he was not aware of that at all. So
right.
There's it's just, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly. So, you know, in getting them help, because then I did call the police. And I told the police officers, you know, I'm concerned for the child because I don't know that this dad is not going to be really angry and go home and beat this child. But then also this child needs help. So they took the kid to Children's Hospital. They did an evaluation and they did all sorts of stuff. And a few weeks later, they actually came back to the clinic and the dad brought the kid and the dad thanked me for figuring it out. He brought the kid in. The kid thanked me, apologized for what he had done, for the hurt that he had caused everybody that was involved, and that he was going to do his best to get better and do better. And then his dad confided in me that the kid told them that he was molested himself, that he was assaulted as a little kid. So we found a problem. Again, we animals are kind of like that first step that we take care of that animal and we report it and we investigate and then we find out what the underlying cause is. So I truly hope that he got help and that, you know, that he's on a good path and he's aware of, you know, kind of right and wrong and that that he's not lost, I guess.
That was just so, that was just one of the cases you told me about. And I was mm-hmm. just like, cause I'm a, you know, I can understand how these things, people hurt people who've been hurt. I mean, mm-hmm. But with these children who are doing these things in so many cases, their parents were not aware. So couldn't help right. them. And mm-hmm. it's obviously that's a more extreme case, but that's where yeah. your skill set. I mean, that's just life changing for that yeah. family, for that child. Like he can get the help and support mm-hmm. he needs through other, right. again, collaboration, other mental health professionals. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure now you've had tons of cases like that, which is probably, yeah. I know we see horrible things, but it's mm-hmm. so reinforcing when we can get
right.
help for these, yeah. again, whether it's a hoarding case or the mm-hmm. case you just described.
Right.
Do you have any other, because obviously that case is pretty mm-hmm. significant, but do you have any other cases of an animal, whether it's related to the forensics mm-hmm. or not, that sticks with you?
Yeah, I mean, there are times that it's like, I'll go into a room. There was a dog that came in for evaluation of a fracture and I went into the room, and the story that the guy told me did not make sense. So again, having the education, the knowledge, and the confidence to say, this is not what happened. And I told them, this is what happened. And the man immediately got really like angry. And I can see that, you know, this man most likely kicked this dog, hurt this dog. So I'll usually go into a room and tell people, you know, this is what I believe happened. And then they'll argue with me. And then I'll say, have you ever watched CSI? You know, like these people on CSI that evaluate things and they know what actually really happened. I said, I studied CSI for animals. So I can look at your dog's fracture and know that this is what happened, that what you're telling me doesn't make any sense. And he actually took the dog and took it to a shelter and surrendered it to the shelter so that the shelter would take care of it. The good thing is that dog got help. The bad thing is that this guy is probably going to go and get another dog, and he's probably doing other things and that kind of stuff. And hopefully, you know, we reported it. Hopefully something gets done. One big case that we saw, and it's a case that I like to share with the vet students, is a man that brought us like a really sick cat that was very skinny, respiratory infection. So the kitten gets treated. And then a few weeks later, he brings another cat, similar condition, very sick, very skinny. Then a little bit later, he brings yet another cat. So somebody having one cat that's sick, or even two cats that's sick, okay. But when it starts being like all these animals from the same house and they're all in really bad shape, exactly. And he was spending the money. He was like, yeah, you know, give him the fluids, give him the this, give him the that. So clearly money was not a concern. And so we contacted the Humane Earth Society and told them we would like to do a health check, because a health check doesn't hurt anything. You know, they and they say, hey, they're just concerned about the cat. We want to see if there's something that we can do. So they kept trying to do health check after health check after health check. And then finally they were able to get into the house. He had over 150 cats in the house. There were, I want to say like 30 to 40 dead cats in the house.
Oh, geez.
So as hoarder as you get, and like the rescuer hoarder, which is a difficult type of hoarder, because they think that they're the only ones that can take care of these animals. So they just keep collecting them and getting them from everywhere. And they don't want to euthanize them because, you know, they can take care of them. And these animals are just dying. So that was, I used that case in telling people, well, checks, that's where it's at. You know, it's, and a lot of humane societies are not going to show up to the people's house in a really aggressive way. Again, they're going to show up and be like, hey, we're just here because there's concern. Are you okay? Is your pet okay? Like, we're here to check. I have sent well checks that the people have been really happy that I sent a well check. Yeah. I sent a well check about a dog that had a fracture that things sounded a little sketchy, and the owner was an elderly lady. So I was concerned about the elderly lady, and the humane officer went in and checked the place out and talked to the lady, talked to the caretaker, and everything was great. And, you know, again, they were really thankful that we cared. So, you know, it's veterinarians and technicians need to learn how to do it, but they need to just have the guts also to get it done, because we help animals. I mean, that's what we're there for. We want to help that animal, but the extension of that, whether we like people or not, the extension of that is we need to help the community.
Yeah. And I think that's a really, if you're going in to do, because I love my ACOs out there. I recently spoke at a conference and I met, I remember their names. I have them written down. They were amazing. These ACOs were so badass. And I was doing a fear-free handling lecture, which is super applicable to super fearful animals. And they were so amazing. And I think that having, again, it's that collaboration where you go in, and in many cases, ACOs aren't set up for success either. Right. They're not given any skills. And they're like, go work with this really, really fearful dog.
Yeah.
And this person that may be dangerous, but we're not going to, that's a whole nother thing. So I think the fact that you even said like, hey, we're going in, we just wanted to make sure that you and your pets are okay.
Right.
Like, you're already instantly, you're not like, I want to check on your animal, make sure you didn't hurt it, which obviously that approach cannot be as that you kind of start something before there is anything.
There is something there,
Yeah. Just those basic levels of communication. And again, we understand that not everyone can do this kind of work, but like how you said, you call the cops or you work with this rescue, you work with the actual caregiver, you work with ACOs, mm-hmm. and you have that. And I love how you, even to that client who was upset with you, how you spoke to him in a way, because I get it. Not mm-hmm. everyone, you know, CSI, because everyone does. And you made right. it understandable and relatable for him. Mm-hmm. But also you were saying like, hey, guy, this is what yeah. I'm seeing. Like, let's work right. through this. Like, mm-hmm. I need you to like, tell me. It's kind of like when a dog comes in on THC toxicity and it's like, right. hey, friend, yeah. I'm not here to judge you. I just right. want to help your dog.
Right. Your dog is either dying of bacterial meningitis or it's just a pot and it's going to be fine tomorrow. So tell me, is your dog going
to
be
right.
alive
and that's
or
where
dead?
It's like, I'm not here to like judge right. you. We just yeah. need to have that. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure like human medicine probably has to deal right. with that constantly as well. Mm-hmm. But I think that approach is so important. Yeah. And that's so cool. Cause I just yeah. found out today she was doing the human forensics thing.
Yes. That's great.
That is so exciting. Yes. So I know obviously you use it every day in, mm-hmm. in work, and I'm sure you've attended some court cases and mm-hmm. testified and was an expert witness and all that stuff. Are there any other things that you're doing as far as the veterinary forensics? Because again, it's such a new thing and there's so many ways it could be utilized, but I right. know it's still such a newer.
Yeah. So one of the things that I want to do is, you know, have people know how humane officers and that kind of know that like I'm available, right? I'm a forensic veterinarian, so I am trained. It's not just a veterinarian that can do an exam. It's somebody that can do a forensic examination, create a report, and then do a expert witness testifying. So the, you know, I provide skills in going to the crime scene. So going either whether it's the hoarding house or if there's an animal that has been abused or something like that, being able to take good pictures, good photographs. I mean, making it as similar to what human forensics are, because when you have to go to court, that's kind of what the court expects. The court expects you to present a case with good pictures, with good information, with good science-based information. So, you know, one of the cases that I did was a starvation case. It was a really sad case because the dog starved to death. But, yes. you know, some of the humane officer did what he could in taking pictures, and they were not great pictures. So, you know, working with them and saying, okay, like you did the best that you could. Next time, this is what I need from you. And they actually went out and got a good camera that they could use just for that kind of stuff. We were able to get that animal do an actual necropsy, which is the animal version of an autopsy, to say, okay, everything about this animal looks okay. So starvation yeah. is kind of like the default.
Yeah.
Be able to evaluate the body and the evidence, like there were bugs. So we actually sent bugs down to an entomologist down in Florida to get a time of death. We sent out samples of the bone to Michigan to evaluate fat content to say, yes, this dog was starved. So getting all that information put together to present it. And, you know, it's just really satisfying to be able to do something that we can't bring that dog back, but hopefully we can bring some justice. And with having somebody that is trained in that,
right,
it just brings more power for the
credibility.
Prosecutors.
No, yeah. I totally understand.
Yeah, the prosecutors and everybody bringing yeah. it over to court. You know, it's not just them saying, well, you heard this dog. Okay.
And you need a lot of, I've had some colleagues from behavior standpoints, and I have been involved in obtaining evidence, and it mm-hmm. is, you need so much.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, so some cases that my one colleague who I love has worked and she shared with me, and there was so much evidence, like so mm-hmm. much and nothing. Yeah. It was a very horrible case. I won't get into it, but mm-hmm. nothing happened.
Yeah.
And I think it's the same thing with, you know, humans seeing people hurt and right. injured, and we want there to be justice.
Right.
But also, of course, data is important. We don't want to mm-hmm. just be assuming things. But I think in the, because other countries are different with their laws, but in America, it can be really, really difficult mm-hmm. for people to take pretty severe, like starving a dog to death is a yeah. pretty severe case mm-hmm. or other types of injuries to animals that mm-hmm. we've seen in numerous true crime cases where they're like, he killed cats at five right. and
he tortured cats, dogs,
tortured yeah. dogs at 10. Mm-hmm. He did this at 12. And then he was a serial killer at 20.
Right. Because it escalates.
Yeah. Obviously it escalates. Yeah. So mm-hmm. I think and like you said, I'm happy about the veterinary forensics thing because I think mm-hmm. it can be helpful again for animals, but so helpful even in cases where humans are hurt right. or injured or killed. Mm-hmm. It's such a helpful thing. And then also credibility
yeah.
amongst judges and lawyers, because sometimes mm-hmm. their perception may be different and right. the evidence is not taken as seriously mm-hmm. for a variety of reasons, or right. it's kind of, I mean, bestiality in Ohio was legal for a very long time.
Right. Yeah. It just became illegal. Yeah, it just became, ago.
And again, I know we're people that fought for it to become illegal, mm-hmm. but I remember senators in Ohio laughing it off because they were like, that's so ridiculous. And both of us have been involved in, mm-hmm. in cases where, that's very real. And I know that right. this is a hard thing to talk about, but mm-hmm. this is happening and it's right. legal here. Well, mm-hmm. it's not anymore, but
right.
it was for a very, yes. very long time. And I even tell other animal professionals and they're like, the fuck? I'm like, yeah, dude. Right. Like yeah. you guys, yeah, yeah.
the case that I talked about with the teenager, when I called the cops, I said, you know, this is what happened. And he's like, well, I mean, there's nothing to do. I said, it's a felony. He's like, no, it's not. I was like, look it up, bro. Because it is a felony in Ohio. So he goes outside and he calls a detective. And then he comes back. He's like, you're right. I said, yeah, it just became illegal last January. It was like, oh, okay. So then it's like, oh, now we got to do paperwork. Yeah, go do some paperwork and get this kid the help that he needs. Like, you know, and I didn't want the kid processed as a felon, clearly.
No, of course.
It is a felony.
Yeah.
And you have to know the law and you don't have to know what's going on, you know? But yeah, I had a case, another case of sexual assault that they didn't press charges or anything because the people said that they didn't do it. And it's like, well, duh, they're going to say that they didn't do it. And it really made me incredibly angry. Yeah. So instead of just getting into a cocoon and getting a fetal position and just crying about it, what I do is, okay, what can I do so that the next time that this happens, I'm going to have more strength behind it. And that's part of the forensic science masters that I'm doing. It's, you know, clearly there's more strength and knowledge in human forensics. Right,
for sure. Yeah.
So how can I bring human forensics knowledge and expertise into these animal crimes? So I now have a kit for sexual assault in animals that is very similar to a kit for sexual assault in people. So that the next time that I get this similar case, I can get information that I can take to the prosecutor and say, here you go. I don't care what he says. He did it. And here's all the information so that, you know, we're able to learn and just keep growing and make it better.
You're amazing. And I love you. and we will get drinks and talk about true crime yes. in the future because yeah. this podcast got deep, y'all. I will put a trigger yeah. warning. But this is, I mean, again, there's some positives here. Like mm-hmm. the veterinary forensics is becoming a thing. It's
yes.
we're becoming more aware as a society of the mm-hmm. of the need to address mental health. Like there's a lot yes. of positives here, but right. as we all know, our jobs have a lot of difficulties. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then again, you're doing amazing work with the Rascal Unit and all your technicians. Send love to them. Props from me. I know I need to just come and bring you guys gifts because Michelle's in Ohio, so she's yeah. local to me. But to end, because I will probably have you back because we could just go on and on about these interesting topics that I don't think a lot of us are talking about, understandably. But what is something that currently makes you happy? This could be your lovely children, which make you happy every day. Yes. It could be your adorable cat that I've seen on the counter all day or throughout the podcast. But what is something that makes you happy? And what is something that because your job is a little heavier than others, not that all of our jobs aren't heavy, what is a way that you kind of decompress and bring yourself to a good mental state? Obviously all the animals mm-hmm. and humans you're helping, but.
So the thing that makes me happy is my son plays hockey and I love watching him play hockey.
Oh, I love
it. Because he is a good player, but he is such a team player. And I mean, it's hockey, so he gets rough. He's chirpy. He's sarcastic. He's his mom's child, right? But I just love watching him play. And he goes out there and he has fun and he comes out and he, you know, he's all worked up about it. So I just love watching him play hockey. What I do to decompress, I love to watch TV and that kind of stuff. But what I really do when I have time, I build Legos.
Because oh, I love like it,
to,
dude.
I like to build things. I like to
It's that genius brain of yours. Yeah.
It just needs to be like going.
Always going.
So yeah. So I love to build Legos and just spend time doing that. And you know, the cats know to respect my Lego table. I got a couple
What's the best thing you've built in your opinion? Because there's some pretty amazing right Lego now, sets.
I know. Well, right now I'm halfway through building a baby grand piano.
Whoa.
That actually plays music. Yes. It's got like 3,600 pieces and it's huge and it's amazing. And I can't wait to get it finished. Every time I sit down in about an hour, hour and a half, I get like 5 packets done and there's 25 packets total. So I'm almost there. So
ooh, yeah, I can't wait to see it. We should have a video on the podcast, on the socials of you playing your Lego piano. I know, right? I love it.
Yeah, and I like Star Wars, so I have a lot of Star Wars stuff.
Oh,
Star
yeah, there's Legos. So many amazing Star Wars. Yeah. Do you have any Baby Yoda stuff? Baby Yoda Legos?
I don't have Baby... No, I don't have any Baby Yoda Legos.
Oh, well, I know. Get you some. So thank you so much for being here and everything that you do. We'll be sure to share the links to all your amazing things. And if you can, a donation would be amazing. Or just sending love to... Rascal Unit and their amazing team. That would be great. But thank you so much for being here. We will hang out soon and talk through crime. Yes. But I really appreciate you taking some time from your crazy day because I know you just got off work and you're like, let's do this. So I appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me. It's a blast. You're awesome too. So, you know, I'll talk to you for hours.
What an interesting conversation with Dr. G. Thank you so much for being here. I'm so excited to see the veterinary forensics field growing because it will be an invaluable tool in helping animals and people. And as a true crime behavior and veterinary nerd, veterinary forensics is so interesting to me. So we will definitely have Dr. G back to get more into it. Thanks for listening, everybody.